And the court will proceed to the fifth case, Sellers versus the City of Gary. Mr. Jones.
Good afternoon now, and may it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the appellant in this case, Mr. Sellers, who's a retired firefighter with the City of Gary in Indiana. Mm-hmm. We brought before this court four issues, two dealing with an equal protection class of one claim asserted by Mr. Sellers, and two dealing with a state law pendant breach of contract claim that were brought, both claims of which were dismissed by the trial court upon a motion for summary judgment. The two issues dealing with the class of one argument that I'd like to discuss with this panel here this afternoon deal with what the proper standard should be for a class of one case, because it's an issue that's been litigated quite a bit before this circuit over the past 4 or 5 years since the Supreme Court recognized it or came out and was clear that it was a cause of action that could be brought. The additional issue on the Class of One claim is whether or not Mr. Sellers presented sufficient facts before the trial court to sustain a Class of One claim for purposes of a summary judgment motion. As to the state law claims, issues there, whether or not the trial court should have retained jurisdiction over the state law claim after dismissing the Class of One claim, and then similar to the Class of One claim, whether there was sufficient evidence presented before the trial court upon which the breach of contract claim should have been allowed to survive a motion for summary judgment. Addressing the first issue, what the correct standard is on a Class of One action, just last year, two decisions came out by this court, Crowley and Racine Charter One. Crowley was authored by Judge Posner, and Racine Charter One authored by Judge Williams. What I think both cases did was recognize sort of a disharmony or a disjointment in this circuit that's come down dealing with what the proper standard should be. There is no dispute that there are sort of two different methods by which to prove a class of one. The first method that, as was set forth in Hilton, requires evidence that the defendant deliberately sought to deprive the plaintiff of the equal protection laws for reasons of a personal nature unrelated to the duties of the defendant's position. That's not the standard that was asserted or briefed by Mr. Sellers before the trial court. Rather, it's the second standard, which allows a Class of One case to be proven simply by showing that the defendant has, without a rational basis, intentionally treated the plaintiff differently than others similarly situated. That's the standard upon which Mr. Sellers proceeded and briefed before the district court. The district court then, under utilizing a version of that standard, denied Mr. Sellers' argument and, in fact, granted the motion for summary judgment, and that's what brings us here this afternoon. Mr. Sellers produced evidence at the district court of both of the primary elements under the second standard. The first evidence that he presented dealt with the similarly situated issue. What the evidence in this case shows is that at the time Mr. Sellers attempted to get health insurance benefits upon formally retiring in July 2003, he was initially told that he was entitled to the benefits by one of the individually named defendants in the case. After making several attempts to follow up on that because he had not begun receiving the benefits, he eventually, by and through his counsel, requested formally the rationale for where the benefits were and how, what he needed to do to get those. In response, the appellees, by and through their counsel, informed Mr. Sellers at that point for the first time that he was not eligible for the benefits. At that point, this case ensued, and through discovery, the appellees came forward with an argument that basically Mr. Sellers was required to, in writing, request within 90 days of his election of benefits that he would like the benefits. This was the first time that reason or that rationale had been proffered, so follow-up discovery was conducted by way of asking for all documentation, all written documentation that showed that this requirement was imposed across the board.
Was there a situation where he could have received health benefits prior to his retirement?
Prior to his retirement, he would have been receiving benefits through the city as an active employee, or at least he would have had the eligibility to receive those as an active employee.
Well, yeah, the eligibility, but did he take advantage of that?
That I don't know, Your Honor. Upon Mr. Sellers making the subsequent request through discovery for the information, what was produced by the appellee's counsel were some forms, all of which were dated sort of in midstream, in the middle of the discovery process, which that was represented as all the forms, the written forms that showed a request for benefits that existed at that time. Mr. Sellers then proceeded to make two different similarly situated arguments. First, he was never provided with any forms or anything in which he could elect benefit continuation coverage. So the six individuals who have been provided the forms and the forms which were received through discovery clearly were treated differently than Mr. Sellers in that they were retirees who had received forms from the city that allowed them.
That sounds like either discrimination or just the breach of contract. I don't know what.
Well, with any discrimination case, Your Honor, there has to be sort of an underlying class-based discriminatory animus there.
Apparently there isn't. So aren't you just left with a breach of contract then?
No, Your Honor, because...
Wouldn't every breach of contract satisfy your standard of deliberately treating people differently because... You know, you'd say, well, they broke the contract in this case, and they honored the contract in the other cases, and that's an arbitrary difference.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And the difference in this case being Mr. Sellers had previously sued the city, and that was, I guess, the impetus for the case in terms of the motivation behind singling him out and treating him differently. Certainly, I do recognize where Your Honor's coming from or what you're intimating.
So you're saying this is retaliatory action?
I think that's a reasonable conclusion that could be drawn by a trier of fact. And certainly at the summary judgment stage, that's the issue before the court. Is that a motivation that a reasonable trier of fact could have drawn? And I think based on the history of previous litigation between the city, which I'll note the city in its subsequent briefing all but concedes did play a role in the difference of treatment between Mr. Sellers and other retirees, I certainly think that raises enough under this court's prior cases, class of one cases, I think that raises enough of an issue that this case should have gone to a jury for determination as to whether or not that was the motivation for the city to make the decision it did in this case. Secondarily, the other similarly situated class, which is identified, are all the other individuals who retired from the city who were allowed to receive benefits who never received any forms and weren't required to submit any forms. Certainly, in the event that the forms were sort of a post hoc, post-litigation attempt to create a distinguishing characteristic between Mr. Sellers and other retirees, that not only is that problematic, I think, for the city, but that's also... it raises an issue of why this requirement, this post hoc requirement, was placed on Mr. Sellers, but not to others similarly situated prior to late 2004, early 2005, which is when all the forms were dated.
Did you argue that in your briefs this theory about retaliation for his suing?
Well, that absolutely, Your Honor. It's noted in the complaint, and it's certainly the underlying basis for the animus in the class of one. It's I mean, I don't know that it was specifically set forth as the reason, but I think that has to do with the posture of this case as it comes before this court here this afternoon. The issue is whether or not he had exhibited or demonstrated sufficient evidence. The court never, in fact, the court noted in its opinion that that the judge believed this was just a straightforward case where Mr. Sellers was suing because he thought he was being retaliated against. Rather, what we're attempting to bring before this tribunal is a showing that under the standards set forth for Class of 1 cases, we had sufficient evidence, and therefore summary judgment denial was improper.
Now, the other retirees who were allowed to opt into the discontinued plan, they had been participating, though, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. In fact, the city notes in its brief that the class of other retirees is not just individuals who opted to continue coverage, but opted to receive coverage at the time that they retired. In fact, the city takes issue with the timing of Mr. Sellers' request, not whether or not he had a right to request it at the time he did. Their argument.
Yeah, but is there anybody similarly situated to his status? In other words, somebody who did not take it when he was eligible to, right, at the conclusion of his service?
Well, he wouldn't have been eligible as a retiree because he couldn't become a retiree under the definition of PERF until he obtained age 52 or, specifically in this case, early retirement through age 50.
He did retire in 1997, though, right?
No. Because of the prior litigation, that was the last time he worked for the city.
Well, right. I realize he was employed until 91, but he actually retired for the purpose of benefits and so forth in 97, right?
For the way the fact was set forth before the trial court was for the city's bookkeeping purposes, he was considered a retiree in 1997, but he wasn't eligible to obtain any sort of retirement benefit through the PERF system until he obtained age 50 or age through an early retirement or age 52 through a normal retirement. So that actual retirement date being used against him only evidences a further, I guess, prejudice against Mr. Sellers, who obtained his right to retire as a normal retiree through a settlement. But he was prevented from being allowed to work.
How old was he in 97?
In 97, he would have been 42. Approximately. 44, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you.
Ms. Wyatt?
May it please the court, my name is Rebecca Wyatt, and I represent the defendants in this case, and I'm collectively referring to them as the City of Gary. The district court decided correctly that Mr. Sellers could not establish a prima facie case for his class of one claim in start because he did not have any similarly situated individuals to serve as the basis to decide whether the city's action was arbitrary and capricious. As the district court noted, he pointed only to these recent retirees who had worked for the city and then retired in 2004-2005. He did not point to anyone who had retired from the city and then years later requested insurance benefits. As the Levenstein versus Slasky case points out, and the district court noted that case in its opinion, it is not always that there is a similarly situated individual. And sometimes I believe this is because of the importance of limiting the scope of an equal protection constitutional violation. Otherwise, it will be as Judge Posner expressed, it's just a breach of contract. It just so happens that it was a public employer who did it. So it's very important to establish that first prong of the class of one, and Mr. Sellers was not able to do it. Secondly, Mr. Sellers points to the fact that he was a retiree, and he compares himself with other retirees. As this court noted in the Racine Charter 1 case, a school, Charter 1 was a school, and there are other public schools and private schools, all of which wanted to receive their an entitlement of free busing. However, the court noted that the Charter 1 school was not similarly situated to either the public schools, even though they were the same, both are public schools, but they were had been set up by different statutory guidelines. That's the same significance that the city believes that Mr. Sellers coming to his retirement benefit through the suit is different than coming to his retirement benefit by working for the city for the 20 years. I should clarify at this point that retirement is once you have worked for the city for 20 years, you are eligible to retire no
regardless
matter.
Of age, right?
Regardless of age.
It's a pretty generous program. That's a very early retirement
age. And but you're not entitled to draw down your benefits right. until you reach a certain age. So we have lots of firefighters, police officers who put in their 20 years with the city, go on to other employment, and then when they reach either 50 for early retirement or 55, then they contact the city to draw down their benefits.
That's both pension and health benefits are suspended until it.
They're separate. And that's one of our points. The pension benefit is separate. The health insurance benefit is offered to all continuing employees and all active employees. And if an active employee retires, like Mr. Sellers in 1997, had he elected to enroll in the city's insurance plan at that time, he could have, but he did not elect to do so. And so our position is that he has he is not similarly situated to these others. We have a rational basis for denying his request for health insurance benefits. And the district court's decision should be upheld. He doesn't have any of the identical traits that that he would need for a comparator. One of the problems that it appears Mr. Sellers has with the city's position is that we have multiple arguments about why our decision is so rational, the first being that it was not included in the settlement agreement of his previous lawsuit. That spoke strictly to pension benefits. And as I've indicated, the health insurance and the pension benefits are distinctly separate. And the district court noted that as well. So the fact that we have alternative arguments or reasons for denying that doesn't make it any less rational. For some reason, in the appellant's brief, he criticizes the city for taking a shotgun approach to our reasons for denying the insurance. I think that's a prudent approach for counselor to take so that we make sure that all of the bases that are valid and reasonable are covered, and that's what I have done. The second argument that Mr. Sellers has is that the federal court should not have retained jurisdiction on the state claims. Once it decided the federal claims, his position is that it should have left the state claims to the state court. However, we were at a point of a motion for a summary judgment. This case had been in the federal court for at least a year and a half. We'd gone all the way through discovery. We may have even had an extension on the discovery cutoffs, but we had thoroughly exhausted everything in this case. We were ready. If the summary judgment did not work, then the city was prepared to try the case. There would have been no point to relinquish jurisdiction to the state court at that point, it would violate all of the notions of judicial economy and actually even fairness to the defendant, the city of Gary. We had to defend ourselves through the federal claim in the court below. If the summary judgment had not worked and we were required to start again in the state court, it would have meant more expense to the city for its attorneys and for the litigation costs. And I should point out as well that the court is well aware that it is within the district court's discretion to retain jurisdiction, and Mr. Sellers would have to show an abuse of discretion in order to have that overturned, and that is very unlikely given the circumstances in this case. And I have nothing further.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Wyatt.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones, your time has expired. You may have 1 minute.
I'd like to address a couple points brought up very briefly. First of all, the shotgun approach, the reason why that's noted and why that's important in this case is it shows the manifest irrationality behind the reasons proffered by the appellees in this case. If there was a rational reason for treating Mr. Sellers differently than the other retirees, then that reason should have been set forth from the beginning and should have been stuck with throughout the course of the litigation. The fact that the appellees, depending on what day of the week or what month you ask them the question, came back with a different sort of excuse for why they were treating Mr. Sellers differently, we believe shows that there is, in fact, a lack of a true rational reason, and, in fact, that the true reason is an irrational one. Secondly, on the contract issue, counsel concedes that the contract's silent, but yet somehow the district court was able to, given the silence of the contract, still grant summary judgment on that. I believe that's, once again, just supports the idea that there was an error made by the district court in ruling on the breach of contract claim. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.